Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 15th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, If You Wanna Know Geology, You Gotta Know Rocks. Session 1 of Basic Geology, Geology of the Holden Area and the Holden Mine. Presented by Don Coberly. Number COD 2003-01. Let's listen in.
Work there, got sent to Holden Village the first time in May of 97 to study the mine site. Everything I knew about Holden Village was on that side of the creek. I didn't know anything about this stuff. And after being here for 6 weeks in the spring of 1997, found out that this is the cooler side of the creek. And so since then I've been back on volunteer teaching staff on a couple of occasions, as a guest on a number of occasions, doing the Elder Hostel sessions last year on geology, and continuing to do mine work all along since 1997. What I intend to do as far as the sessions go is talk really loud and fast for about 40 minutes straight, and then we'll take a 10-minute break, and you can go and use the bathroom or get a drink or whatever, and I'll figure out what I'm going to say for the next 40 minutes. And then I'm going to run that 40 minutes really hard, and then we'll get out of here. So that's there'll be a 10-minute break in the middle. My watch is going already. If when the beeper goes off, I can finish what I'm saying in a minute or less, I'll continue. If not, I'm stopping right there, and we're quitting. All right. I have a handout that is kind of, I guess, like a syllabus, kind of more of a general explanation of what I think in the heck we're doing here, and covers sort of the topics of the sessions and some other things that I think you need to know. And I don't teach in my business life. This is about the only time I get to do this. So you may be mistaking enthusiasm for terror. I was talking to somebody last night about, and it might have been Ruth and Dorothy, about maybe I would get bored doing this. And my thinking about teaching is that when you start, you're terrified, and when you end, you're bored, and somewhere in between those two, there's like that kind of casual, easygoing, we got it all happening time, like Mary Jo and Gloria had this morning, and I expect Kristen had next door, but I'm not anywhere in that easygoing yet, so that's why things seem to move kind of fast sometimes.
Did you have more handouts?
I really don't.
Oh, okay. We have more.
If there's a stack that's still left somewhere, or if people who like each other would share a copy, that would be nice. Okay, as I mentioned last night at the or yesterday afternoon at orientation, there are two sort of distinct topics that I intend to cover this week. The first one today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and a little bit of Thursday. Basic fundamental geology. Just as simplified a geology as I can think of. And then half a day Thursday and all day on Friday, talking about the mine site in particular and the stuff that I know pretty thoroughly because I've been here and done most of it, or done the groundwater portion of it anyway. There'll be sort of two distinct parts, and you are welcome and free to visit whatever parts of this you want to. And if you want to learn about geology but not the mine, then I won't see you on Thursday after break and on Friday, and that's fine. How many theses did Luther have, like 94, that he pounded up on the... I just got one, so it's way simpler. And this is my sort of distillation of what I think about geology and why it might be interesting. And I've got it on the paper here for you to all keep with you. And I've got a copy of it up here too, because I think it's kind of important. And that thesis is, at its essence, geology is an observational science. That is, it is based on observations of rocks, landforms, and the relationship in space of rock units to one another. Once observations have been made, it is possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. After hearing that we had a crossword puzzle expert in the village last night, it sort of came to me that in some ways geology is very much like doing crossword puzzles. That you read the clue of the crossword puzzle and you write something down. And that to me is completely analogous to going out and looking at a rock and saying, oh, I've got a certain kind of rock here. And you walk around and you look at the clues. The same way that as your blade, I assume, this is the way I would do a crossword puzzle, is you get all the easy ones first, right? Cat, dog, hat, the. And then you use those clues that you have in place to help you get the harder words. Because you got some of the go on a crossways words, now you're trying to get some of the up and down words, you already got some letters. So because I know some things about the geology of the area, I can make some guess, I can advance some hypothesis about what might be happening between those two places where I think I know what's going on. And as I think also happens in crossword puzzles, every now and again, you find out that your first guess is wrong, right? You write a word down and it doesn't match up with the stuff you got going crossways, so you go, well, that can't be it. Or maybe one of those crossways words is wrong. So that's the way, to me, that geology works. You go out, you look around, you come up with an idea, and then you go and further investigate that idea. To me, there's nothing magical, nothing really complicated about that. That's totally common sense. If it's crossword puzzle, you know, it's precisely the same thing. Geology is doing puzzles. The schedule that I've got written out here, today we're going to talk about rocks in a little bit. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the basic concepts of geology, or what I call the laws of geology. They're very simple, fundamental concepts of geology that work here, there, and everywhere, that you can use wherever it is you happen to be. They don't just apply to the Railroad Creek Valley. And the point of that is, the goal of that is, that after these sessions that you will be able to take a book from the Roadside Geology series, drive someplace and do geology. Now these books, the Roadside Geology series, are not available in the bookstore, and I wouldn't order those in because people come from different places. But there is a series called the Roadside Geology. I've got ones for Arizona, Oregon, Washington, Colorado. I think there are two books in the set for California, one for Northern California and one for Southern California. The point of the reason that I like these books is there's the cartoon world of geology books, and there's the way too bloody complicated world of geology books. And these are sort of in the middle, that if you take a little bit of time, and there's a glossary in the back, and you're at all interested in geology, the other part about these being the roadside geology is if you're going from here back to Wenatchee on the road, you'd look in the book and it shows that map and the trace of the map, and it shows what geology is exposed there. And so if you want to go take a geology trip sometime, you get the book out, you look at it, you get a little bit of a head start on what might be there, and then you go and do geology. And another one of the things I think about geology is it's not an experimental science. You don't do a geology experiment like you think of a chemistry experiment. You read the instructions, you put stuff in something, either it blows up or it doesn't, you write down results, you give it to the teacher and you get a grade. Or it's not a calculation science like math is. You don't do a geology problem like you do a math problem. You do geology by going out and seeing it. And so that's, again, that ties into the observational nature of it, and it also, to me, ties into the sort of common sense nature of it. The father of modern geology, James Hutton, was a farmer by trade. He wasn't a geologist by training. If anybody's read the book, The Map That Changed the World, Simon Winchester's book, about the first geologic map of Britain that was done by a guy who was a canal builder. He didn't go out doing a master's thesis on geology. He was building canals, and he wanted to. He had done enough of them to know that when he ran across certain rock units, all the water went away. Well, that's a problem. I think it's a problem if you're building a canal and all the water goes. You got to do something about that. So, in various places that I've been, if you want to learn about the geology, you go find some old farmer, and they'll tell you about it. Not because they've got a lot of geologic training, but because they've been out on the ground all the time. And they're not trained in the science of geology, but they're observant people. And that's the thing. Geology isn't magic. The assumptions that goal that I wrote down sometime last night, and I don't remember why it was that came up, was that I had a second goal here. And the second goal is that you understand that geology is not magic. Geology is common sense. And everybody here has the capacity to do geology because everybody here is reasonably thoughtful. Otherwise, you couldn't figure out to get to the boat to get up here, right? and to make that point, I don't want to embarrass anybody for answering this question one way or the other, but how many people here have had a college course in fluid mechanics? College level course in fluid mechanics. There's four of us.
Fluid mechanics.
Bernoulli's equation, stuff like that. Okay. The question then is, can you move bigger particles of rock with fast water or slow water? How many people say fast water?
Fast water.
Okay, the point is, you're right. You move bigger particles of rock with fast water than you do with slow water, and you don't know that because you've taken college-level fluid mechanics. You know that because fast water kind of has more power, and it seems like it would move stuff, right? That's a common sense thing. Geology is exactly the same way. When you look at flood deposits, the stuff that's in the center of the channel is the biggest stuff. When the Missouri flood or the Mississippi floods every year, you don't get boulders coming over the side. You get fine-grained material coming over the side because that water has lost its velocity. The power to move the big stuff is all drained off, and now all you're doing is moving silt and clay, right? That ain't fluid mechanics, that's common sense. So that's the point. That's the second goal that I have here, that if you never do geology again, if you never think about it again, or if you think about it only when you're riding along in the bus and you see something, it's not magic how that got there or things along those lines. It's stuff that you probably already know. And it's just we're going to tie together some of those things, and hopefully I can point out some of those things, and you'll go, oh, yeah. And from then on, you'll know it. You knew it all along, it just needed to be brought out a little bit. Okay, the assumptions I have at the bottom there are that you have some interest in geology, some level of interest, or else you wouldn't be here in the first place, and that you might get into it a little bit further, and that if you do that necessarily, you're going to do it away from here. Right? We could do a very thorough study of the Railroad Creek geology, and by the end of the week, everybody would know this stuff really well, and it wouldn't be much use to you until you came back here, and then you could show off for your friends, or if you went someplace else that had geology just the same as it is here. And there aren't that many places that are that way. So my for the first 3.5 days, this basic geology stuff it applies everywhere. So that when you go back to California, or you go to visit on the Front Range of Colorado at Colorado Springs, the same stuff applies there. So that's the first 3.5 days. The last 1.5 days is stuff that I know more about. Tonight at 7:15 here, Rick Dunning will be giving a talk about the Holden Village history and the mine history. And for those of you who are interested, he's a better person to learn that from than I am, because he just knows way more about it, and that would be an hour well spent, I think. I'll be here. I'll listen in to what he has to say. We'll tailor that first half of Thursday session kind of to fill in, or if he gets everything and more than I would know, we'll just move into looking at the environmental investigation earlier on Thursday, and I can do a more thorough job of that. I have handouts that I will, this one and anything that I give you over the next few days, you're welcome to take if you want, or you're welcome to leave if you want. My feelings won't be hurt. But there, tomorrow in particular, I've got a set of handouts of the more basic geologic concepts that you can take with you and have, and it will lead, may lead you into other resources. The internet is full of geology. There's a community college in wherever it is that you live that's got a geology teacher. He's there because he'd rather teach than do research like the college professors, and so he's going to be a better resource for what you want to learn anyway. All right. I said geology is an observational science. I think of that as being a science of the senses. We don't really need... At deeper levels, at more complicated levels, we use pieces of equipment, we use instruments to measure things. James Hutton didn't have a whole lot besides a hammer and a magnifying glass, and he invented geology. So you can get a lot done with not very much. It's a science of the senses, mainly looking. We'll go out and we'll look at rocks and we'll look at where they are in the landscape, and I'll use a compass and we can measure the orientation of that in space. But primarily, it's going to be the visual observations that we make. But that's not the only sense that we have. There are other tricks of the trade that I've learned using all of the other senses. One of the things that we do in our business that we need to classify the size of the material. And when we talk about sedimentary rocks, we'll talk about that a little bit more. But silt and clay are different size particles. And it's important, particularly in construction, to know which of those you have. And one of the ways you can tell that is if you have some of this mud that comes up, or a core that comes up, and it's soft and it's silt or clay, and you don't know which it is, you make a little paste out of it between your fingers, and you hold it up to your ear. And clay, the particles are smaller, and it feels real buttery, and you don't get any sound. Silt, the particles are just a little bit larger, so that you hear this kind of scritching sound next to your ear. So if you're driving by and there's geologists doing geology somewhere and they all got their fingers up to their ear, you'll know what they're doing. So it's important, your sense of touch and your sense of hearing. Use everything that you've got. Your sense of smell. If you have a rock that has sulfur in it, or that you think might have sulfur in it, if you wang on it with a hammer a few times, you'll get that sulfurish smell. The same way that up on the tailings piles here, those tailings piles have been sort of, they've been leached or rusted out on the surface, and that sulfur has been transformed chemically and has gone away. But if you dig down into the tailings, into the stuff that hasn't been touched by a lot of water yet, you get that same sort of sulfurous odor. So there's your sense of smell. I kind of wish Mom wasn't here for this part, but there's also, it's not necessarily your sense of taste, but it's your sense of texture. And another way to do that silt or clay test is to take a little piece of that material and put it in your mouth and get it on the tip of your tongue and rub it on the back of your upper teeth. And again, if it's real buttery, that's clay. If it's a little bit grainy, that's silt. Next time you're down in the pot shop, you can do this test on your own. You can see whether it's really clay that you're molding with, or it may be a clay silt mixture. And I don't do that a lot. And I particularly don't do that when I'm at hazardous waste sites. I kind of do it kind of in the cleaner side of things. All right. Any first level questions about what the heck's going on here before we get on into honest to goodness geology? The first thing to talk about in geology is rocks. I assume you can't very well do botany if you don't learn about plants, and you can't do forestry if you don't learn about trees. So rocks are the basic unit of study in geology. If geology is a language, the rocks are the specific words. And at the simplest level, there are three primary types of rocks. There are only three: igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. Metamorphic, from whatever the same root of metamorphosis is, meaning change. A metamorphic rock is a rock that used to be something else and then got changed by some processes. The things that change at the Earth's surface or nearby are pressure and temperature. So the only two, the physical properties that change anywhere near the Earth's surface are the pressure that the rock might be under and the temperature it might be exposed to. I'm going to blaze through these really quickly just to get them out there, and then we'll talk more about each one. And just so you know, this stuff, I'll try to keep up a little longer. I've got another board here for when we're doing scratch pad stuff. That's where I'll do work when questions come up, or if I want to point out something that I'm going to get rid of. So this stuff will stay up for a little while longer, probably for the whole day or at least for the 40-minute session. Sedimentary rocks made of sediment. Sediment is particles carried by a fluid. Sediment in wine is whatever the stuff is, which is carried by the fluid of the wine. Sedimentary rocks that get deposited offshore are deposited by flowing water. What other fluids do we have? Air is a fluid, or it has fluid properties anyway, so it can move sand enough to create sand dunes, right? So those are sort of a sedimentary deposit. Ice is a fluid, particularly in glaciers, and it will transport material. That stuff, when the ice melts, that stuff gets dumped out, and now it's a sedimentary deposit. So that's what, when you see sedimentary, think of sediment. It's the solid material. It's been carried by a fluid and then deposited. And igneous rocks, I haven't come up with a good way to make any sense of this. Igneous rocks are rocks that are formed from a molten state. So, at the simplest level, those are the only three kind of rocks you got: igneous, sedimentary, and metamorphic. If somebody comes up to you and says, "I've got a rock behind my back," guess what kind it is? I'd say you should guess sedimentary, because 70% of the rocks that we can get our hands on anywhere near the surface of the planet are sedimentary. So somebody asks you that question. Now, if anybody holds that rock behind their back and says, "Guess what kind of rock this is," and you guess sedimentary, they'll be wrong, but you still got to go with the odds. A good thing about that is, from sedimentary rock, and again, one of the reasons I think geology is a kind of a cooler science than like forestry is, if you go out and look at a tree and you say, "What kind of tree is that?" Well, that's a cedar. Okay, what else do you know? You might know something about the environment that you're in, because cedars don't grow in the desert. And you might know how deep it is to water, because cedars probably have some. That's about all you can tell. If you have a rock in your hand, or a set of rocks, that's a picture back into time. You can look at what used to be here or where that rock came from. There's a way bigger story that a rock can tell than a tree can tell. Now maybe that's just personal bias, but I think it's true. In So I want to talk about sedimentary rocks first, because they're the most ubiquitous that we can get our hands on. And as well, at least some of them, I think, can tell us more. There's more that you can read into a sedimentary rock than you can kind of the other kinds. The first subdivision of sedimentary rocks is either clastic, made of clasts, which are particles. Right? Is everybody familiar with that term? Or a clast is a specific grain or a particle. So a clastic rock is made out of grains. The other kind is a chemical sedimentary rock. Limestone is by far the largest of those, which is composed of the skeletons of microscopic organisms. These clastic rocks are made up of grains of some kind of mineral rock or some other assemblage of minerals, another piece of rock. The things that we might be able to tell, first off, one of the first things to try to get to is, how do you tell the difference between a sedimentary rock and an igneous rock? Let's work at those two first. What you have in your hand is an igneous rock. An igneous rock is a rock that has solidified from the molten state and therefore is made of crystals. What you will see if you look at your igneous rock is you have a grain in the rock that's black colored, and another grain in the rock that's white colored, and another grain in the rock that's gray colored. And some of these have very sharp and regular edges, and some of them don't. But when you look at them, no matter how closely you look at them, where they contact, you don't see any space in between the grains or the crystals. In a sedimentary rock, particularly a larger grain-sized rock, and we'll talk about that in a second, you'll see the particles, and maybe they'll be round, and maybe they'll be oblong, or whatever shape they are. But in between them, you'll see some space that's filled in with cement. Here's another grain right here. And you have a piece of igneous rock in your hand. I will pass around a piece of sedimentary rock, in this case a sandstone. This is a hand lens, which is a fancy term for a magnifying glass. Most people have magnifying glasses. If you're a geologist, you get hand lens. If you want to do geology and you got a magnifying glass, use that. If you want to spend $15 at a scientific supply store, you can get one of these. And you look at the rock and you hold the magnifying glass up and you look. And if you look at this rock in particular, you will see very specific individual sand grains with a little bit of chewing gum holding it to the next grain. In fact, it's a cement. I'm not sure whether it's a silica cement or doesn't really matter. If you look at your igneous rock the same way, you will see no cement. You may see matrix material, finer crystals that you can't differentiate, but you don't see the spaces between the individual grains. That's the simplest way to look at these. Another way is to feel it. You can feel like this rock right here, or you can feel a piece of sandpaper, and they feel essentially the same. An igneous rock will feel a little bit, the igneous rock that you have, I don't think feels quite like sandpaper. So that's the, no matter how big a magnifying glass you get on your igneous rock, you won't be able to see specific individual grains. So, with a sedimentary rock, the size Sedimentary rocks are made of clasts, are made of specific particles, and they range in size. From big to small. And some of these terms you already know. And some you might not. Boulder is bigger than a cobble, is bigger than gravel, is bigger than sand, is bigger than silt, is bigger than clay. This is not tremendously important to the basic study of geology that we're talking about. It does get important in construction, things like that. You want to know precisely what size particles are available or are present. And when this sediment becomes lithified, when it becomes turned to stone, you get things that you know or probably have heard of. Everybody's heard of sandstone, right? It's a rock made out of sand-sized grains. Siltstone, people are generally familiar, at all familiar with that. It's a rock that's made out of somewhat smaller-sized grains. And claystone is made out of even smaller-sized grains, which are called clay particles. Siltstone, silt is the size particle that you can just barely see if you bust up a siltstone or if you run into a material that's silt-sized. And you wash it onto your finger, you can just barely see a silt grain. I have on this handout a Xerox of a card that I used back in my offshore oil days to investigate the size differentiations between sand sizes. I blew it up so that we could see some of the other characteristics that I'll talk about in a minute, but this shows you, at least in the oil patch terminology, what a very coarse sand looks like and what a coarse sand looks like and this is for the sand size particles. And of course, once you get below this smallest sand size particle, now you're in the silt ring. The things that we can learn from looking at that rock, let's do a quick thought experiment, which is the scientific term for make-believe. My boss comes to me and my buddy Jamie, who's a young 32-year-old guy who loves backpacking, and says, I need to know about the geology of the Railroad Creek Valley. I need to know what rock units are up there, and you guys go and do it. And Jamie's young and loves to backpack, and he thinks this is the greatest news he's ever heard. And he throws on his backpack with probably 3 weeks' worth of provisions, and he goes hiking out into the mountains. And I like to sleep inside, and I like to drink coffee, and I like to go to the pool hall and bowl. And I don't want to work near as hard as he does. So while he's out there climbing on all these hill slopes and looking at rocks and eating his freeze-dried food and getting rained on and chipping off a piece of rock and throwing it in his backpack, what I'm going to do is go down to the footbridge here and kick around in the water and look at the rocks that are in the water. And after a while, I'll just sort of visually look at them and start throwing some of them up on the bank, because they look different from each other. And I'll do that in a day. And then I'll probably hike a little bit up the valley to where Big Creek comes in. And I'll go a little ways up Big Creek and I'll do precisely the same thing. I'll pluck some rocks out and throw them on the bank, and I'll write some notes down in my field book. And at the end of that time, he'll come back broken, bleeding, tired, happy, with a backpack full of rocks that are that I've already seen because I've let my friends gravity and fluid mechanics do all the work for me. The point of that is the rocks that we see at the footbridge up here are reflective of the drainage behind us, right? That's where they come from. Physics and fluid mechanics argue that's about the only place they can come from. So when you see a rock and when you see it in place, if you're at Estes Park, Colorado, and you go into the Big Thompson and you do the same thing that I was just talking about, that's reflective of the rocks that are behind you. If you're at Colorado Springs and you look at the fountain formation, which is what makes up the red rocks, have people heard of red rocks in Colorado? Or Garden of the Gods is at Colorado Springs. There's these big columns of rock or big layers of rock that have been tipped up on end, and they're red and they're huge. If you go and look at that stuff, that what's in those rocks will tell you what the source area geology was like. I'll show you a picture tomorrow. Well, actually, I've got the picture right here. We'll see it as an overhead tomorrow of a rock that I took a photo of in one of my trips to Indonesia. That rock is a volcanic rock where the volcano erupted and this mixture of hot gas and ash came off the side and ran over the ground and ripped stuff up like you were, if you were pressure washing your painted something before you repainted it. The pressure and the speed blasts this stuff off the siding and incorporates it in. And that's precisely what that is a picture of. So that if you would look at that and look at the clasts that are involved in that rock, you could make a guess as to what material that hot gas thing flowed over. It picks stuff up. The same thing that in time, when this material that's in the creek now is no longer sand and gravel and cobbles and boulders, but has turned to sandstone, 5 million years from now, when the young geologists are out and they're banging around on that stuff, they'll be able to say, oh, well, I know what was up further up the canyon. So those rocks, those sedimentary rocks, those that have grains big enough that you can see, give you a clue as to what was uphill from you. Now, one, I think, interesting point in my little make-believe between me and Jamie is I would have a couple of rocks in one of my piles that he doesn't have. And we think, how in the heck did that happen? We got gravity and fluid mechanics on our side. How can we get fooled by that? And we start casting about, and at some point we stumble across the fact that we knew some geologist in Canada who knows where those rocks come from. And they were brought in by a glacier over the top of Cloudy Pass right here and deposited in. So I've got them in my rock piles, and he doesn't see them in any of the wall rocks around here because they didn't come from here. So that there are, to every rule, there are some exceptions. In this case, my rock pile that I've collected in between drinking coffee and going to the snack bar has some stuff in it that Jamie's, the true representation of what's out there, there's a little bit of difference there. But that source area geology is one of the things, one of the clues that we can get from looking at a rock. I've got a little bit bigger sized piece. It's still too small to be able to see really without, this would be the next thing up from a sandstone, which would be called a conglomerate, something that's a graph conglomerate. That's not a foreign term at all, right? It's some mixed up, mushed together thing, right? A business conglomerate is something that they do all different kinds of things. Conglomerate rock is the same thing. Again, if that were just a little bit larger, we might be able to see the specific grains and identify them as a piece of limestone or a piece of shale or whatever. And if we knew where that came from, we could look back and we could say, okay, here's the place that came from. Any questions? Please.
The picture that's going around, I already forgot the picture.
It's a picture of a rock that I took a photo of in Indonesia. And that rock is a sort of volcanic equivalent to a conglomerate. And it picked up, it started its life being blown out of a volcano as a mixture of gas and ash, and flowed down the side of the volcano, and it was moving so fast and with such force that all of the ground that it ran over, it picked up and incorporated hunks of that as part of the fluid, the gas mixture. It finally got far enough to cool and settle out and solidify, and now all of those fragments that you see, and if we knew, if we could follow that path, or if we didn't know what the path was, I'd look in that rock and find out what the rock types were that were in there, and I'd look on my map and say, where do we find those? Maybe we can trace back where that might have gone simply by following the clues back. Go ahead.
I can understand why you had some rocks that your friend didn't have up there.
His idea would have been...
What was her question? Well, he said that when he picked the rocks out of the creek, that he had more rocks than his friend who hiked up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand where those came from.
Okay. This will probably take a minute. Here's Railroad Creek in blue, and it turns and goes up to Lyman Glacier and Lyman Lake. And another creek comes in this way, Copper Creek comes in this way, Big Creek, and then there's one more little one here. And the point is that there are mountains all the way around here. There's a little valley right here called Cloudy Pass. And I care about this from the water perspective because water that falls over here goes another way and I don't care about it. So all of my investigations are going to be when I'm looking at rocks in the creek are going to be here and here and here and here because that reflects what's up here. That reflects what's up here. Jamie is going to go hiking through all these mountains, all the way around, and collect up his rock fragments and bring them back. The thing that's going to confuse us is at some point in the past, a big glacier came in that was carrying rocks from Canada, because that's where it started and started grinding things and started picking them up. And it came over this pass and down the valley. And when it melted, at one of the times it melted, it dropped those rocks out that we don't see reflected anywhere in this drainage because they're not from the drainage. So that's the exception to the rule. And that's the thing you have to consider is how. And another way to get stuff is you got a sneaky geologist who's been to Indonesia that throws some rocks out of his pocket just to confuse the local. All right, 10-minute break. Somebody asked where these books are available. These are available at most Borders, Barnes & Noble-ish, kind of standard chain bookstores. Sorry?
REI.
Sometimes the national parks have them.
These are widely available, and they are available for lots of states. I don't know if there's a roadside geology in Nebraska or not, but it'd be really short. But there are half a dozen other states of these that I've seen. Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. Somebody else asked something else that they wanted me to highlight, and I've forgotten what it is. Back to clastic sedimentary rocks. The second thing that we can think about is the distance from the source. Let's do another thought experiment. We have a rock fall that happens. Somebody heard one up in Copper Basin yesterday. Boom, the end of the rockfall. We take a bunch of, we take our imaginary dump truck on the helicopter and take it up there and bring it down here. And up at the laundry, we have industrial size rock tumblers, right? Rather than just the little rock tumbler that you see that you make jewelry out of, we got the biggest ones on the planet. And we shovel a bunch of stuff in there, and it's all soundproof because when we turn it on, it's going to make a heck of a racket. And we turn these things on and let them go. And we come back 10 days from now, and we fork some of that stuff out and we look at it. And then we walk away and we come back a year from now. Those things have been going the whole time. And we, at the end of a year, we fork out another batch into another pan. How are those things going to look different? The day of the rock fall, what we're going to see in any representative amount is all different sizes, right? You don't just fall rocks all this size, like marble size. You see everything from silt size to freaking Volkswagen size. We throw all that in the rock tumbler, and what happens? Big pieces run into big pieces. They bust each other up. The little pieces are escaping in between the big pieces, so they're probably still left alone. But after some period of time, the differences in the grain sizes diminishes. The day that everything falls, everything's all sharp and jagged. Nothing falls rounded, right? It all falls sharp. After a week in the rock tumbler, things are starting to knock angular edges off of. And after a year, everything is a little more round. Same thing you do for the real reason that you use the rock tumbler. The other thing that might happen, and particularly if we throw some water in there with it, is those materials that were less resistant in time would be lost. The water, the abrasion, some chemical reaction happens so that if you have rock types, parts of that stuff that are of a specific rock type that isn't real resistant, it'd be gone. We could test the water and we'd see the residual of it in the water. So the environment, I think of as being the world's biggest rock tumbler. When stuff falls on day one, it's all angular, it's all different sizes, all different types of rock are present over thousands of years or tens of thousands of years. As that stuff spends time, how does that rock get from there into Lake Chelan? It takes a while. Gravity, rainstorms, gets it into the creek. Small events don't move it, big ones do. It starts getting closer down here, somewhere down. Right? Same thing in the Front Range of Colorado. That same process happens everywhere. And what you see over time, and I think of this distance from the source, either in space or in time, to the end where you're left with everything is precisely the same size or reasonably the same size, and it's all rounded up. And it's all the same stuff, and it's only the most resistant minerals that we find. That handout that I gave you above of the card, the smaller of the two is the true size, so that you could see what those size gradations were. The second one that's been expanded has been blown up to show those ideas of angularity and the idea of sorting, which are two more concepts that geologists use, where if stuff is really angular and it's really poorly sorted, it's probably pretty fresh, or it's probably pretty close to where it originally came from. It didn't spend a lot of time or space in the rock tumbler. If it fell and then somehow were lithified up there, you would get this really angular stuff. The same way with our volcanoclastic thing. Everything here is all angular, because in geologic time, this thing happened in a heartbeat, right? You blow up the volcano, this stuff comes down the same day, solidifies the same day. This is an absolutely instantaneous event, and all of the pieces that got picked up along the way had no time to get rounded, and when they got picked up, they got ripped up, so there was nothing smooth about it. So this thing is really fast, and this thing, the volcanic flow that came down, the gas flow, didn't flow thousands of miles. It flowed maybe tens of miles. So those angular, at the one end is really angular, really poorly sorted. That's new stuff, either in space or in, it's either new short term in the rock tumbler, not very far from where it originally came from. At the very other end of the spectrum is all the same size, all rounded up, only resistant minerals left. Now you know if you find that rock, that stuff has that had a long path to get there. And particularly in looking at sandstones, because we can visualize, we can see them, and they have the grains that are big enough, there is a whole subdivision of the sandstone class based precisely on those two issues, and then you make the leap back to where those came from. Again, the rock, to me, the rock can tell you more than a tree can. The last thing, and it's sort of tied in with this, is the energy and the consistency of the environment of deposition. Where was this stuff deposited? If it gets deposited up in the middle of a copper basin and for some reason that material becomes lithified, the energy of that was very high energy, right? A rock fall. At the very other end of the spectrum is low energy and very consistent. And to me, the idea that comes to me is a beach, right? A beach.
Oh, beach, yeah.
If there's anything more regular on the planet than waves coming in day after day for tens of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years, millions of years, it's at the beach, right? And what I have here in these two jars, they're the same, is a material from Wyoming who was saying Wyoming has all the geologic types on the planet. This is a sand that is mined in Wyoming and then processed very minimally, and then I use that in the environmental business when I put a well in the ground to put around the well to help water flow towards the well. And it's incredibly rounded, and it's all the same size, and it's all silica, which is of all the mineral types the most resistant. And so that stuff, in for much of the geologic history of the United States, for hundreds of millions of years, the area between what we now have as the Rockies and the Appalachians was this very broad, shallow inland sea. And Wyoming was where the mountains were, and so there was a beach on the east side of the mountains, where for millions of years, that stuff got tumbled every day, and all of the other materials that were less resistant or either physically or chemically resistant were put into the water, and that's all that's left. That's the toughest stuff on the planet right there. So that's the picture. If you find a sandstone made out of that, you know it's been around for a long time. You can't get clean sand like that, all silica, without having had it spend a long time in the rock tumbler. If you see this rock, which is 20 different kinds of stuff in it, and it's all angular, and it's all sharp, and it's all different sizes, and it's all different shapes, and there's nothing round about it, this is new, that's old. Is there anything, again, I don't see that as being at all anything other than common sense. All right. It's time for the quiz. Up here we have something you can't hardly see. All right. This is a concrete wall that somebody sawed a hole into. And I was doing something else there, and here's a little tree in the background that you can see. And it hit me that this was a really good visual for a make-believe sedimentary rock. And if we go back to the thesis of the whole session, it's we make observations first, right? Based on the observations, we make some hypotheses. So we've talked a little bit about grain size, we've talked a little bit about sorting, we've talked a little bit about angularity. What have we talked about anything else that made any sense at all? Probably not. So what are the observations of what you see? If this thing, rather than being a concrete wall, which we know it is, if we're out hiking around tomorrow and we find this thing, what do we observe? Rocks are round. Most of the rocks are rounded, right? There's the occasional one that's got a little angularity to it, or there are these kind of disc-shaped rocks in it. That's one thing.
Small.
In the grand scheme of things, there's not a whole wide range of variety in the rock sizes. There is some, because we see the at least half of this is made up of rock fragments that or rocks that we can see. And then there's that matrix in there that's too small for us to see. Apparently, a number of different rock types are present there. You don't want to use color as you're discriminating if you can do other things, but in this case, it's all we got to look at. So yeah, we've got a number of different colors of rocks. If we're making the first simplest guess, we're going to say that all of the blue-gray rocks probably come from the same area. It's possible it could come from two different places, but that's a more complicated picture. Let's go with the simplest one first. I don't know, what does anybody else see? There are a couple of pieces that show a little bit of some kind of a reaction around the ring, around the edges. That would be, so there's somehow in our make-believe rock, there is some reaction between the matrix, the finest stuff, and the clasts. So that, again, all observation. You don't got to know any geology to do this. Then, based on that list of characteristics, now we make some assessment of what we think this thing really is. It doesn't make a lot of sense, because this isn't an actual natural rock. This is something that somebody put together to build a concrete wall out of. But that's the process that you go through. When you see a rock that's got pieces big enough for you to identify, you're doing geology. No different than I would do will do on the hike when we look at stuff. We'll go through precisely the same process. What are the observations? Don't think about them, just write them down. Big, little, angular, rounded, same, different. Sound like a ophthalmologist. Same, different. Same, different. Right? And then, based on that set of observations and conclusions, then we do the arm waving part of where did this come from. All right, everybody pass the quiz. That's what I'm going to tell you about sedimentary rocks. We covered 70% of the rocks. Somebody asked me what the rocks are in the walls out here. They're probably predominantly igneous and metamorphic. The response was, well, I thought you said 70% of the rocks were sedimentary. That's over the planet that we can see. We're in a little bit of an anomaly. If you go to Illinois, it's all sedimentary rocks. You can drill a well 10,000 feet deep, 15,000 feet deep, and you never run into anything but that. So that 70% is the rocks that we can get our hands on the surface. Igneous rocks, the first break is either extrusive or intrusive. Extruded, toothpaste pooping out of the toothpaste tube. Cake frosting, it's extruded. Play-Doh, getting pushed out through the little thing, right? Extrusive rocks are those that are, what's a better term for pooped out? Hawaii, is our Hawaiian? The Hawaiian lavas are extruded to the surface. Intrusive rocks are those that intrude to some depth, and I don't mean 100 feet, I mean tens of kilometers, 5 or 10 miles. Come up from down below, come up very slowly, cool along the way, and are emplaced as nearly solid rock at that point. Mountain building continues to push this, physically push things up more into the environment. The rock tumbler takes care of that and wears it down until we can see the granites at Yellowstone. Those granites solidified at I don't know what, I'll guess at 20 kilometers, 12 miles below the ground surface. And then physically the ground surface was raised enough and now we've eroded down through them. The thought experiment to do about that is we have a pan of what's the stuff that you make by heating up sugar, the candy,
and then
you let that cool. Isn't there some candy like that?
Yeah.
Peanut brittle.
Something along those lines. In scientific terms, we would say we would take a pot full of boiling water and we would fill it up with copper sulfate or something like that. And since it was boiling, we could oversaturate it. We could get more in there at boiling temperature than it would hold when we cooled it off. So we got three pans of this stuff. And one pan, we turn off and we run it into the freezer and we set it in the freezer and we leave it there. And the next pan, we just turn off and let it cool under its own cooling rate. And the third pan is boiling, and on day one, we turn it down 1 degree. And we come back day two and we turn it down one more degree. And we come back day three and we turn it down. For the next 3 months, we're turning that bloody thing down 1 degree at a time. And then at the end of that time, we collect our three pans and we look at them. What we're going to see is in the pan that was flash frozen, we'll look at it with the hand lens and we won't be able to see any crystals at all. It solidified too quickly for those crystals to form. The way that crystals form is they find some little piece of contamination, some little hard thing to fall onto, and then they start to build out from there. And they form as the fluid cools. So that if the stuff cools instantaneously, in geologic terms, the lavas of Hawaii cool instantaneously. They're molten today, and if they're not cool by tomorrow, they're cool by next week. A week in geologic time is nothing. The middle pan may have crystals that have started to form, and they're really small, but we can still see them with our hand lens. And our pan that we've been cooling down 1 degree at a time is going to have 3 or 4 really huge crystals. Because we've allowed it to cool slowly enough that those crystals can be formed. The Earth works precisely the same way. So the igneous rock that you have in your hand or sitting next to you or wherever you dropped it is somewhere in that middle range. But as a first guess, if you go to Hawaii and you look and you don't know anything else about it and you take your magnifying glass with it and you look at the rock and you go, I can't tell anything about this. Well, the crystals are too small. Your conclusion will be those crystallize very rapidly. And then you'll turn around and there will be a lava flow coming towards you. And somebody will say, don't worry, it'll cool before it gets here, and then you'll be right. The same way that the granites or the large crystal igneous rocks that you see at Yosemite or wherever else you happen to be where you've seen those can't have crystallized rapidly. They're just it doesn't work out. You got to have time for those crystals to grow. This, the rock that you have, is sort of somewhere in the middle, so the guess would be that this either got relatively close to the surface before it cooled, so it didn't cool instantaneously nor really slowly. That would be the first thing that would come to my mind, that this made it fairly far up to a cooler surrounding. Or this stuff might have been on the fringe of some bigger gob of rock that was coming up, and simply because it was in contact with the cooler rocks around it. I'd want to see, I think if you would go to Yosemite, one of the things you might see, and we'll talk about it more tomorrow, is as you get closer to those boundaries, the crystal size decreases. Because that stuff is in contact with cool in-place rock, and so it cools a little more rapidly. There's not as much time for the rocks, the crystals to grow. The other thing that we see in nature sometimes, you'll see a rock called a pegmatite that has some very large crystals in it, and then all of the surrounding material is really fine-grained. Conclusion there is? Anybody? How do you get big crystals? Cool things slowly. How do you get little crystals? Cool things quickly. something starts part of its history cooling very slowly, and then for some reason there's an earthquake and there's a fissure, and now this stuff gets much higher. You've taken this stuff that was in the process of cooling slowly and minding its own business and making big crystals, and you burp it out towards the surface, cool it down really rapidly, and now you have two very distinct crystal sizes. When you determine you have an igneous rock in your hand by looking at it with your hand lens, and one of the things that you will see in an igneous rock is sort of the regular shapes, which are due to the mineralogy, the specific chemicals that bond and how they form together, and you'll see little square, in some of these you'll see little square end-on views. If you're looking at your rock, and in there, in some places you'll see very regular shapes. And probably, or you may see the sort of side view of it. That ain't natural, right? That's not a sedimentary rock. That's not something that's spent very much time in the rock tumbler, or else all of this stuff gets busted off. And what you wind up with in the sand jars is all rounded stuff. If you see square things or diamond shaped cross sections or hexagonal cross sections, you don't very often see this on the microscope or the scale that we can see with the hand lens. The only way you get that is from the cooling from the melt or cooling from the molten stage. So there is time for the molecules to arrange themselves slowly. So that once you decide that what you have in your hand is an igneous rock, if you've got all small grains, too small to see, it cooled fast. If you've got big grains and that's all you got, it cooled slow. If you got some of both, it did some of both. So, a couple of questions in the back.
Which one first? Okay. Having done a lot of hiking in the Cascades, I occasionally see columnar basalt. Is that one crystal? Is each of those one crystal? And am I to infer then that there was extremely slow cooling then?
That's a larger manifestation of the underlying chemistry. As basalt cools, the microscopic form that takes is that hexagonal. Those, about basalts in particular, the way to look at how those cool is the tops and the bottoms are the fairly straight stuff. The all stuff going all different ways in the middle, it's like, I think of it as being a peanut butter sandwich. You got bread on both sides and it's pretty stout, and in the middle as that stuff on top cools, you've got this weight, and now the stuff in the middle just kind of oozes every way it can. So basalt cools fairly rapidly, and basalt is runny enough, and this is another way that sort of the chemistry gets reflected. The lava, the Hawaiian volcanoes are pretty flat, right? Because that basalt's really runny. When it comes out, it can go a long way pretty quick. But you don't ever have really catastrophic explosions on Hawaii. You have catastrophic explosions on Mount St. Helens because that material, just because of the different chemical composition, is way more viscous. And now instead of trying, play a joke on somebody and take all the toothpaste out of their tube and put oatmeal in there, and now they're squeezing the tube to death, trying to get the oatmeal on, and blows up. Well, it's precisely the same idea with the regular toothpaste is a Hawaiian volcano. The oatmeal is Mount St. Helens. It's so sticky coming up that it takes a whole lot of force to get it out of the tube, and when it does, something really bad happens. So that's another reflection of the underlying chemistry and the way it goes to the viscosity. And so when you see Hawaiian volcanoes, they're low and flat. When you see Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens till it blew up, and Mount Rainier, they're all pretty stout, right? Because that material that finally comes out is still pretty viscous. It cools more rapidly. It doesn't run very far. Now you got these big cones rather than the low-lying flat ones.
Thank you.
So,
well, pretty much in the same vein, And it's what I was wondering about, like in Men over at the Sisters, where you see the obsidian. I'm sure that I know it's a crystal, but isn't it that forms? The black obsidian.
Obsidian in general, I think of as being non-crystalline, crystallizing very rapidly. I would think that you don't see, if you look at an obsidian face with your hand lens, you don't see any specific crystals in there.
But is that unique for that area, or is it pretty?
Obsidian in general, the characteristic of it is it's something that has cooled very rapidly, mm-hmm. cooled so rapidly that there's no ability for crystals to form. So that's it. We could look in the dictionary after session here.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
There's so much of it. You know, there's so much of it there.
It's like glass.
Yeah, and you just walk around and pick up.
Yep. Well, the basalts that the Oregonians and anybody who's in the Columbia River knows, that stuff is just bloody everywhere. It flows for miles and miles and miles. And again, the only way you can get that and be able to trace a bed over 5 or 10 miles, it's got to be pretty runny stuff when it comes out to be able to flow far enough to get 10 miles away or 100 miles, 50 miles away before it cools, right? All right. Metamorphic rocks, rocks that have been changed, they've been metamorphosed. The things that change at the surface of the earth are the pressure and the temperature. If you have some material like a shale, which is a clay stone, another way, back to our fluid mechanics issue, stuff that comes off the general continent of the United States or goes out into the ocean. The stuff that we see closest to the shoreline at the beach is sand. If you move offshore a ways, what we see now is muck, the sediment that is smaller particles that have gone farther in quieter water and then they settle out and you get muck, you get mud. You stick enough weight on top of that mud, and now it starts to lithify, turn to stone, and now you get shale. Even farther out in the ocean, past everything else, is where you find limestone, because that's the skeletons of the critters that can live out there, and then they die. So if you could cut a big cross-section through the western United States out toward Hawaii, you would see the sands being relatively close to the shore, and then you would see a bunch of shales, and then you would see the limestone out in the deep ocean. You stack up a bunch of this mud on top of each other, and now it turns to shale. I wonder this was... And stack a little bit more on top of it and push it even harder and make it even denser and make it even tighter, and now you got slate and you make pool tabletops out of it. Right? It's even, and so it's been changed, it's been metamorphosed to be even more dense and more tough than the shale that it was. If you find slate, which is what you make pool tabletops out of, the only way that you can get that is if the pressure is from straight above. So you get it's all flat and it's all regular. If you get any pressure coming in from the sides, like we'll talk about on Thursday, the sort of the idea of plate tectonics, where the plates are moving around on the planet of the Earth or the surface of the planet, and they sort of head towards one another. If you get that compression, now your slate starts to develop some ripples in it and becomes a schist. And so if you find a slate or something that is really flat and regular, your guess is the only force on that has been vertical, as it's been lithified and then metamorphosed. You know, you can't get any sideways pressure on that stuff and still have it be as flat and as regular as it is. Now, if you start pushing not only just on the top with that additional weight, but you start pushing on the sides in some compression, now you start to get what used to be these flat-lying sheets. Now you push on those flat-lying sheets, and they start to become hummocky and wavy, and you take a slate and you turn it into a schist, which is a metamorphosed rock that shows that waviness to it. If you find, go ahead.
Is that S-H-I-F-T?
S-H-I-S-T, schist.
S-H-I-S-T.
S-C-H-I-S-T. If, go ahead.
Are fossils metamorphic?
No. Fossils, if you find fossils in rock, that rock can't have undergone very much or those fossils would be lost. So fossils are, you never find them in igneous rocks because the igneous rock has cooled from a melt. If you take a bone and throw it in a pot of boiling rock, the bone burns up and you never see it.
Yes,
what about petrified wood?
Petrified wood is silica, that same stuff that the sand was made out of. Water containing that, permeating the wood, and sort of mimicking the structure of the wood, cemented up, essentially. But fossils, you'll find fossils in sedimentary rocks in this process of metamorphosis, particularly if you add temperature to it, you're going to lose those fossils. So sedimentary rocks is where you'll find fossils. If what I've been doing with the slate to schist is sort of, we increase what we do to it as far as the pressure and temperature. At the bottom of this scale will be igneous rock again. Once you push on this stuff hard enough and you heat it up enough, it remelts, and now you're back to making igneous rock. This schist shows this waviness, or called schistosity. The next step is, if this stuff stays under that field, the pressure and temperature long enough, the minerals